Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki, episode 129, recorded Thursday, January 19th, 2012, in Yuri's Dreams. Welcome, everyone, to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I'm Dr. Kiki Sanford, and once again, this is the hour of the week in which you get to hear a conversation, maybe even be part of a conversation about some topic in the sciences with an expert in that topic for the entire hour. I mean, this isn't a soundbite show. This is a conversational show. This is where we dig into stuff and, you know, help you to appreciate the world around you that much more. And in this case, today, we're going to be digging into spacey science. We're going to be looking into the story of manned space flight with our guest, Ryan Kobrick from yurisnight.net. And in the process, we're going to be not just looking at the world around us, but getting a bird's eye view of that world, hopefully, and man's role in exploring the universe. But first, before we dig into the conversation, I have a few science headlines. Drum roll, please. Off the top of the ticker, maybe force fields are real. Well, near field forces, that is. Researchers at the University of Southampton in the UK predict that optical light can produce an attractive force stronger than gravity when used to excite electrons, otherwise known as plasmons, on the surface of metamaterials. Those metamaterials are placed close to a metal or dielectric plate. In essence, the paper suggests the potential for gecko-like adhesion that can be controlled by the flick of a switch. Yes, you too could be Spider-Man. While we so often hear bad news about emerging and mutating diseases around the world, good news like this is rare. India, after embarking on a massive immunization campaign, has had no new cases of polio for a year. Astronomers using the Kepler Observatory found a super Mercury orbiting its star at just 900,000 miles or 1.5 million kilometers, which takes approximately 15.7 hours to complete. That's right, hours for the orbit. The heat from the star is vaporizing the planet, creating a comet-like tail of gases that follows closely behind. Ocean acidification was shown to negatively affect fundamental neural development and function in damselfish and clownfish larvae, suggesting that increasing CO2 will be problematic for many more species than just those with calcium-based shells and skeletons. High aquatic CO2 levels reduced lateralization and predator avoidance behavior and were linked to changes in regulation of the GABA-A receptor. Scientists evolved multicellular yeast in the lab. That's right, they evolved a multicellular species, originating with single-celled Saccharomyces cerevisiae, or baker's yeast. It took only 60 days of growing cells in culture and transferring them daily in a way that favored multicellular growth to result in multicellular clumps of yeast with a new form of reproduction and cell specialization within the masses. The study suggests that the evolutionary step from uni to multicelled organisms was probably not as much of a big deal as people have assumed. For those of you looking forward to an extra second at the end of this year, maybe you're one of those people who habitually run late to the 10-second countdown and a leap second would help you out. Well, you can rest easy. The decision to abolish the leap second has been postponed until 2015. So at the end of this year, it'll be 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 1. And then the ball will drop. And finally, popcorn was eaten in Peru 1,000 years earlier than previously thought. That's right. They enjoyed popcorn a lot earlier. That's it for the science news headlines for this week. It's time to dig into our science conversation of the hour. Dr. Ryan Kobrick received his bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, his master's of space studies degree from International Space University in Strasbourg, France, master of science in aerospace engineering from Pennsylvania State University, and a doctorate of philosophy, PhD, in aerospace engineering sciences focusing on bioastronautics from the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's worked with the XPRIZE Foundation. He has also worked developing the follow-on event to the XPRIZE called the XPRIZE Cup. And additionally, he's been involved participating as a crew member in the Mars Society's Mars Desert Research Station four times on crews 25, 44, X Beta, 56X Gamma, and 58F Mars training. He was selected for a 100-day Mars mission simulation in the high Canadian Arctic on Devon Island, Nunavut, at the Mars Society's Flashline Mars Arctic Research Station. And he facilitated the human factor studies for the crew of seven, as well as being a crew engineer on the FMARS Crew 11. He was named executive director of Yuri's Night in 2010. And Yuri's Night is a nonprofit organization with the aim of connecting thousands of people around the world to celebrate and honor the past of human spaceflight while building a stairway to the future. He started working at MIT as a postdoctoral associate with Professor Dava Newman in the Manned Vehicle Laboratory. And his primary role for the start of this was as event director for MIT's 150th Anniversary Exploration Symposium named Earth, Air, Ocean, and Space, the Future of Exploration. In his free time, he plays hockey, sails, skis, scuba dives, hikes, and makes short comedic films. And so today, Ryan, I just want to talk to you about the comedy films that you make.
Yeah, that's fine with me. It'll be a really short conversation, so.
Okay. Now, I mean, you have this this wonderful biography of a whole bunch of steps that, I mean, they really show your interest in going to other planets. I mean, everything you've done has kind of set you up on this, I want to go to Mars or be part of figuring out how to go to Mars. What started this in your life?
Well, I guess it started way back. I've always been interested in space. When I was little, I used to look up at the sky and go and look at the stars and go, hey, I want to go there. So I've always been an explorer, and space just kind of brought me in. When we were young, like when I was about five or so, went down to Florida and got to go to Kennedy Space Center and got to see cool stuff. I still remember that I had a sticker book with little astronauts and rockets in it. And just little things like that were kind of setting the pace or maybe even brainwashing me, who knows, into being a space advocate. And I really believe that our future as for humanity is in the stars, and to explore and to go further and to really push limits like that. So yeah, I've always been interested in everything to do with human spaceflight. And I've tried to be involved where I can, where all the opportunities come up.
How have being involved in things like Mars simulation research, how has that been a part of your path? And also, how has that kind of worked into your educational path? Has it interfered at all?
I wouldn't call it interference. I don't know what some of my advisors would call it, but it's been important to me for sure. And the reason I've been involved with a lot of the analog research is that, you know, in order to figure out how we can effectively explore on places like the moon and Mars, going back to the moon, is related to training. And in order to do that, we really need to look at what's the closest environment to that situation. And obviously, we can't mimic the gravity that we would feel on Mars. But in certain locations like Utah or up in the Canadian Arctic, we can really get an understanding of the types of geology and biology field work that we would be doing on a Mars mission. And because of that, and then you add in the constraints of wearing a bulky spacesuit, losing mobility because of it, and big, heavy gloves, and you lose the dexterity when you're holding on to something. It just adds to the simulation more and more. So those experiences are, I would say that they are probably addictive. They're really fun too, but they're really hard work. So I've enjoyed doing those analog research stints at both Utah and the Arctic.
I know that one part of that research, that area of study of trying to figure out how could a mission on a planet like Mars go, how could it happen? Getting the crew together, trying to think about how people would work together in virtual isolation. I mean, we know we kind of have a working laboratory in the International Space Station that's orbiting above our planet. But, you know, what is it like to just kind of go out and be really out of contact? Because with simulating something like Mars, you have the time delay in communications. You know, what is that like?
It's intense. And the longer that you're out in the field, the more intense that it becomes. So the ones in Utah are only 2 weeks long. So it's just enough to get an idea of how you would live and work on Mars and, you know, some of the minor issues that might come up working with the crew. But the Arctic, we were up there for 100 days for all 4 months of the summer. And so there's a lot of time for things to stretch out. You really have to have good communication. And luckily, we had a really good group of 7 of us that were up there. We got along really well, and we were able to carry out all our science research. We were doing over 22 different science projects up there. And so everyone had a little bit of invested interest in some of those projects. And so overall, everyone wanted to help each other in sort of an academic environment of wanting to get good results and, you know, prove that we're doing good work up here and that this is a valid simulation or analog that can be used for research.
What kind of studies were being done?
So I mentioned geology and biology. One of the geology projects was looking at the permafrost and how the layer of the permafrost was actually migrating with the seasonal change. And that's actually something similar to what they did on the Phoenix mission up in the cap, polar cap of Mars. Where if you look at the ground surface, you'll see these cracked lines, and they're called polygons. And so these polygons are indications of the freeze-thaw cycle, so how the water moves around, how the surface is cracking. And so we were looking at similar ways of measuring that as well. So there's a lot of overlap in projects. The investigators that worked with us on our projects were from NASA, the Canadian Space Agency, from industry, and different academia as well. So I was involved with the human factors research. So the human factors research is where you look at the human-to-human interactions. You look at the human-to-computer interactions, human-to-habitat interactions. So basically the human in the loop of a system. And we had a whole bunch of projects that were looking at group dynamics. We were doing reaction time tests on something called WinSCAT that they actually use on the International Space Station. So it measures how fast you can click the button, and it becomes important over time to see how that affects crews and their reaction time and their working load as well.
Were there any really interesting results that came out of it that you can share, or is it confidential?
Yeah, so, well, no, there's not too much confidential from the mission. It was all pretty open. We were actively sending out blog reports, and reports back to Mission Control so they could put them online and let people know what we were up to. But we have published a lot of the work as well. I think one of the more interesting things that we learned about, and it's not a quantitative result, but qualitative, was we studied Mars time. So when you're up in the Arctic, it's 24 hours of sunshine. And so you can just make your own clock while you're up there. So what we did for an entire month was we blocked the windows with just cardboard that we use for the regular nights, but we just keep changing the hours. And with our mission support, we actually went on Mars time, which was 24 hours and 37 minutes. And we slowly migrated around the world by doing a bit of a time shift. So that was a really cool project. And so what we saw qualitatively was that we were getting hungry at weird times for the first week or so. But then after about, I think it was a week or two, we were adjusting to having a longer day. And it actually worked out that we felt more well-rested just because that little bit of extra time each day.
That's something that everybody is looking for, that little bit of extra time in every day. So really, to get that, we need to go to Mars.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think this is one of the selling points that we can use for people who are, you know, maybe not quite sold on manned missions to Mars. Be like, no, Mars is great. This is one of the places where you can go and actually get that extra sleep that you need.
Yeah, instead of ISRU for water or, you know, methane, we've got time. We should be exposing that as much as possible.
yeah, exactly.
TV networks would love that.
I know. So with the with the analog research, I know there've been some longer missions that have been completed more recently. Have you been keeping up with the more recent work that's been going on for these simulations?
Yeah. So there's, like I said, there's a lot of different ways you can simulate a crew for a mission. And the Mars 500 crew just finished up a few months ago. And for their mission, they were just looking mostly at the isolation component. So they had their team locked up in a simulated space station that was in transit to Mars. And then they went into a small Mars chamber for a few weeks to be like they landed on the surface of Mars. And then they locked them back up and they brought them back. So it was over 500 days that these guys were working together in a very, I would say, pretty confined environment. Although they had the knowledge that they were close to help if they needed it, they weren't in an extreme situation, but they were very isolated. It's not like they opened the door and talked to them. They had them locked up and they used different Mars time delays. So the longest time delay that you would have going to Mars is 20 minutes. So as they got further away from Earth in their timeline, they were increasing their delay and then decreasing it on the way back. So that was really cool. Coming up in Hawaii next January, there's going to be a 4-month mission where they're going to do something similar to what we did in the Arctic, but they're going to concentrate on more of a lunar analog. Being on a volcano is a lot more analogous to lunar terrain in terms of mineralogy. And so they're going to get some cool results from that. And they just opened the call for people to apply. So if you want to go to Hawaii for 4 months, but locked inside of a container.
You're not going to be surfing.
No, you can surf before and after, but you'll be inside most of the time or in a spacesuit. But it sounds like a really good opportunity. And I hope a lot of people apply to that.
Yeah. In terms of the human factors, was there anything with the longer mission that's come out of the research from the Mars 500 group yet, about personalities and team interrelations and just, I mean, the psychology of this fascinates me.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything available yet for them, so we'll have to stay tuned. And it's really hard to do I guess, psychological data from such a small group, because if you show, subject N, even though you don't, or number 4, you don't say their name, you can kind of figure out who it was based on the crew composition. So there's a lot of personal data that's there too, but collecting that data is really important, because as long as we're, you know, using the scientific method and protecting people's privacy, then we can get a lot of great information to send on to them. So we'll see what happens for that one.
In terms of the selection process, what are they looking for? Particular psychological factors, particular skills and traits for the different team members?
Yes, and I can't speak too detailed on it because I don't know, because I've printed it out to read over and kind of make that decision if I'm going to apply or not. Different dynamics now. So I'm getting married this summer, so I don't know if I can run away to a Mars/lunar simulation for 4 months, but we'll see what happens.
Congratulations on getting married, by the way. Did you win the contest? I didn't see the outcome. There was a contest that you entered that I helped with in Twitter.
Yeah, so we entered a wedding ring contest, but we didn't win that. We came in second.
Too bad.
Yeah, it's okay. But we're looking forward to our wedding this summer, so it'll be a lot of fun, rings or no rings. And, you know, I really want to go to space one day, so whatever rings we have, hopefully I can bring them up with me and or Jen will go before me. Who knows?
Yeah, which one of the two of you is likely to go. So these rings have been in space. They will be. So for the psychology of these kinds of selection processes of getting people together in a small group. I mean, there's a certain amount of it that I probably inspired, or maybe the real world inspired selection processes. But, you know, when the real world first started out, and even now this MTV program, that the producers are looking for a very particular type of cast. They want stereotypes of different behaviors and different types of people. And so, you know, there's a video component where you tell them who you are and then they interview you. I mean, how do you get selected? Does it feel like you're trying out for MTV?
For this, it probably won't be like MTV. I mean, when we were applying, it was a whole formal application. It was a group of us that applied to go to the Arctic together. And mm-hmm. we talked about what kind of research we would be able to run up there. So it was a team effort. And for this next one, it'll be something similar, either, you know, the individuals or there might be groups that apply for it as well. But it's mm-hmm. not really the MTV style. They want the right. the skills, the ability to do the work in the field. The aspect of being able to communicate to the public is very important for spaceflight, given that we have such a small budget, and it's important to relay to the general community what we're up to and the important spin-offs that come from space. For all those reasons, it is important to be able to get the message out there, but that's not sort of the top priority for these simulations.
Right. In terms of the simulations application outside of going to Mars, you know, there's the likelihood that, okay, we're never going to go to Mars, probably more likely that we'll go to the moon again. Is there other applicability from these analogs that comes out?
Absolutely. I would say every single study that happens within the analog, you could probably pick apart and say, here's where the terrestrial application might lie. Something as simple as understanding the permafrost in the Arctic can tell us about how global climate change is affecting the environment, what's happening in terms of the temperatures in the surrounding area, the wildlife, and how it's affected by that, and then mm-hmm. More downstream, how that affects everyone else. So overall, each project does offer some unique aspect to increasing our health and livelihood here around the planet.
Not just this particular movement of getting to Mars, of trying to figure out how we could possibly go to Mars. It all started years ago when we, not the United States, but Russia sent the first human into outer space. And you are involved with a group called Yuri's Night. And can you tell us a little bit about Yuri's Night and what it is celebrating?
So yeah, I'm proud to be involved with Yuri's Night. I'm currently the executive director, and that's the logo you can see up here on the wall and on my t-shirt over here. So Yuri's Night is a global celebration of human spaceflight. It celebrates our past, our current space program, and our future in space. So Yuri Gagarin was the first cosmonaut, the first human to go into space on April 12th, 1961. And then on that same cosmic date, on April 12th of 81, the first shuttle was launched. So April 12th kind of got this focus of, hey, let's do something to celebrate human spaceflight. And so the founders, George Whitesides and Loretta Hidalgo Whitesides, said this would be a great opportunity to bring people together, especially young professionals interested in space, to get them to celebrate. And how can we link together people together around the world? So they started Yuri's Night, and the first year was 12 years ago, was on 2001. So we've been celebrating it around the world in different ways ever since.
It's so hard to believe it was 12 years ago that the first Yuri's Night celebration took place. I actually remember coming across it on the web because I was looking for different space related stuff. And it was, this is interesting. What a neat idea. And people were trying, the idea of making it a worldwide celebration, I think, is so fascinating, trying to get people to celebrate it everywhere. How successful is that? Has that been in the last 12 years?
It's been growing every year. Last year, we kind of, well, we break records every year because it grows every year. But we really broke records last year. We had over 600 events in over 75 countries around the world. And we had that big push because it was also the 50th anniversary of human spaceflight. So 50 years since Yuri's first flight. And so that got us a little bit more attention and a bigger push. So we're talking about jumping from 2010 with it's a lot of parties, 222 events around the world to 600. So I'm hoping that we continue that trend and increase those numbers again this year. It's going to be exciting to see where Yuri's Night is in 10 years from now. And if it'll be, you know, globally celebrated like a St. Patrick's Day or a Cinco de Mayo, and if it'll have that hallmark happening to it, I guess you could say. But I've been involved with Yuri's Night since 2003. I met George and Loretta at some sort of space dinner that we were at a deli in LA when I was working at XPRIZE as an intern for the International Space University. And they're like, oh, yeah, you should come up to Pasadena. We're meeting about this Yuri's Night thing. It's we're going to get together and we're going to do an outreach event for families with JPL. And then we're going to go and celebrate at LAX at Encounter, their theme restaurant. And I'm like, okay, that sounds like fun. So I got involved, and that was my first event that I was helping with. The JPL Education Day was a lot of fun. And then, of course, the night party was also a lot of fun. And I think that's what really brought me in, was that Yuri's Night wasn't just about one group of people celebrating, like just say a giant party, but it was something that everyone could enjoy in different ways. And you could really engage the public in a lot of different venues. So right away, mm-hmm. I was hooked. And from that, I ran two events when I was at Penn State at State College. And then when I was in Boulder, I ran the Boulder events for 5 years. And then when I came up to Cambridge, I was transitioning to the executive director role as well. But I was like, okay, I think I'm done with organizing the individual events. I'm just going to concentrate on the global aspect of bringing people together and try to help facilitate the backbone that the Yuri's Night executive helps put out there so people can connect, register their events, and participate in cool contests and all those cool things.
In terms of, it sounds like a great excuse to have a party. Human space flight, yes, big party. But it more than just being a party, what hopes for educating the public do you have?
Well, I guess it starts with the basic hope of people realizing, one, that human spaceflight is really important and that human spaceflight is really cool. We're sending people up into space, and there's people living in orbit right now, going round and round our fragile oasis, looking down and inspiring us daily. And that's just unbelievable. And I think that the opportunity in the near future for lots of people to be able to voyage into space is just around the corner. And I think that's going to change a lot of people's perspectives on Earth and their home. And by being able to look down and see how everyone is so closely linked, and that becomes really important for our future on this planet.
Yeah, everything seems to have, as I look at the science and technology news that's out there, everything seems to have a very global angle these days. Go ahead.
I would say Yuri is one of our first global visionaries. There's a quote on our website that where he looked down at the Earth and saw no borders and called for everyone to come together and unite. And that was a quote that I believe he gave in a speech after his flight. And it was very unique. We're talking about the height or leading into the Cold War. And it was very military for someone to say something like that. And so he really was someone who represented all of the planet, not just sort of one country and one way of thinking. And that sort of global unity, he's one of the, not one of the first, but he's one of the first space people that did that, of course.
I haven't read much about Yuri Gagarin, other than the fact that he was the first man to go into space. How was he changed by the experience? Did it affect the way he went forward after the fact? Did he use it as the seeing no borders? Did that really make him make changes in his life and try and act on that?
I would think so. I mean, I can't just say yes. I know that he did travel around and he did do guest talks for different dignitaries. So he was very passionate about sharing that message. And unfortunately, he died really young in a plane accident. So he really wasn't, we weren't really able to see how that legacy would unfold. Mm-hmm. But every astronaut that's been up into space, almost everyone has said the same thing, that the experience is really, even though they knew that they were going to probably have some sort of global experience, that they were more than blown away by what it actually did to them. And I think the fact that most astronauts on their own time, their own efforts, are doing all this extra community work and talking about their experiences is tribute to that experience. Right now, Ron Guerin, who was up on the space station during the last Yuri's night, and we'll talk about in just a sec about how they celebrated, but he's involved with a group called Fragile Oasis. And that's a group that's part of NASA that's really looking at how people around the world, can get involved and really try to make a change for our planet.
Yeah, I see the opportunity to use the notoriety of being an astronaut, being somebody who's been in space, to be able to bring a message to a really large number of people is just a huge opportunity. From Yuri moving forward, how did we have a change in space flight? I mean, it was Yuri, and then the United, there was the space wars where the United States were like, we have to get people in space. And, and then everything kind of went downhill, and there's space shuttle. And
well, all of it happens on a crazy roller coaster, as you just demonstrated. So we've been all over the place, and a lot of the space industry is tied into how things are funded. And I think that could be kind of our next thing that we're looking at, is that there's a lot of commercial companies that want to make this happen and want to move away from the one customer model and really feel that, really feel that there's markets out there, such as tourism, suborbital research, that will generate enough revenue to kind of push these new areas forward. So we could have some cool stuff on the new horizon here.
Yeah, I've seen recently there's more and more talk about creating a museum or museums on the moon, basically taking Apollo landing, the landing sites or different sites around the moon and not changing them.
Yeah, I know that with the Google Lunar X Prize, they have talked about how do we preserve the older sites. And I think they've become World Heritage sites, even though they're not on our world. But they've definitely thought about what to do about that and how not to interfere with preserving them. But, in a futuristic kind of way of looking at it, how much of the moon are we going to move to and settle on? So if we're looking at a lunar colony that's going to spread all the way across, then of course we need to protect those sites. And that'd be pretty cool to just put a dome over it and you got a mini museum right there. So.
Yeah. I can just imagine walking out along some kind of walkway to go view a landing site.
Cool.
Yeah, looking at bits of trash that were left by the astronauts who landed there. there is a lot of trash left on the moon, but that's a completely different conversation.
I don't know if I would call it trash. That's there's some good hardware that you could reuse maybe, but it's going to be covered in lunar dust and a little bit chopped up and clogged. So I don't know if you could use it again, but it would be cool to see.
Right. It would be very cool to see. Where are we now in terms of the movement to get more people into space? I mean, we have all these long views of, okay, we can go to, we want to go to Mars. We want to go to the moon again. We have people in the space station, but now we're kind of in between, here in the United States, we're in between vehicles. You know, other countries are really the way that we're getting into space. And then there are private concerns, but you know, what kind of, what's the situation currently?
Well, I guess the realist way of looking at it is that we're coming up on an election year, and that's going to affect the pace of how things unfold in terms of the budget, the way things are spent. But it's also an opportunity for projects to get pushed forward. I think in general, though, over the last few years, what's really made a difference is how people are now connecting to each other through technology and also through social media. So those areas are really helping with the global movement itself. And I think in turn, that also helps with the way things are happening in the space industry. Just a few years ago, you had NASA starting to get their astronauts to tweet from space and from all over. And now it's we're getting to the point where it's the other way around, where we've got astronauts who already had Twitter that are going into the their future space flights, and it's already integrated as part of their life and how they communicate to everyone. So little bits like that really help tie us together. And I think a couple of really good examples were just some video that were sent down from the ISS, the International Space Station, a few months ago, looking at the Aurora Borealis and the nights, the lights at night from just one or two orbits. And it's just unbelievable. It was like the best footage I've ever seen from space. So it's just, you know, the little things like that, that, that technology has helped us view what's going on a little bit more and more. It's made a big difference.
Yeah. And with the internet and social media, the connectivity and the opportunity for just about anyone to be able to see those videos.
Oh yeah. Oh, there we go. There's a video going now. Yeah.
Yeah. Where once it might've been, you know, a few people would get to see it, but it wouldn't spread that far. Now anyone who can access the internet can take a look at it, and it's absolutely gorgeous. To be on the International Space Station would be amazing.
Yeah.
You've gone through a lot of, you know, your education, the Mars analog missions. You know, you may or may not end up going to space in your lifetime. Probably, you know, for sure by the time, you know, maybe your kids will go to space easily. What kind of things... for people who want to go to space, what kind of things should they look at doing? What kind of things are important to be able to prepare yourself to get to go to space?
I think the number one thing for relating to just getting to space or wanting to go to space is to do what you're passionate about. If you're passionate about music and space, then you should really go down that road of exploring what you do as an artist, and then you try to make your path kind of converge with influences and inspiration from things that you see in the cosmos. I think that kind of applies to any field. I mean, if you like to build things, I like the way things work. So I like to kind of take something apart or put it back together and go, okay, that's how that connects to that. And that's what kind of really interests me. So I think that aspect made me want to become an engineer. I wanted to know the aspects of how things fit together, and that kind of pushed me forward. And then I was like, well, I really want to do, you know, cutting edge research, and I really want to obtain a PhD, because it's kind of like the top project, so to speak, that you can do in the academic world. But until you kind of transition into the after graduate student life.
Right.
So I've always been interested in that. And so it's be passionate about what you want to do and try to see how you can tie that into space. And I think that's what Yuri's Night is really good about, is that it's bringing people together from all the different disciplines. It's not just a bunch of space geeks that like rockets or work on rockets getting together to talk about space. You've got people who are writing songs, creating art, writing novels, and you know every aspect of our culture is somehow involved. So it's just a matter of what we're trying to do in general with Yuri's Night is try to connect those people to each other so that they can learn from each other and experience all the cool output that they've got going.
Yeah. On my other program, This Week in Science, my co-host is convinced that sending people into space is a waste of time and that we should really just focus our energies on sending robots to different places in space. You know, what can you argue for the benefits of sending people?
Well, I mean, there's so many. Where do I begin? It's just things that the human brain can see and perceive just can't be programmed. And if you could program it, it's because a human's programming it. So there's only so much you could really get into a robot anyway. So you really miss the big picture of how things fit together by just having this streamlined output from a robot. So I think there's a lot more that a human can pick up on, the situational awareness of where they're at and what they're doing. There's just many, many things that make humans dominant in that field. I'm not saying that I'm against any robotic exploration. I think it's important to have robotic exploration go to those very difficult places that humans might not be able to survive in. It's important to send them out there to survey where you potentially would like to land, what kind of resources are going to be available, the basics of dust dynamics, especially for the moon, Mars, and asteroids. So there's a lot of aspects where robotic missions are important. And then, of course, for just the general surveying and collecting data in terms of different instruments that need to be done on a repetitive repetitive downlink. That's, you know, ideal for satellite infrastructure and potentially surface robotics to do those kinds of exploration things.
Hmm. For you in going to space, what do you think are the next steps? Where do you think your opportunity is going to lie?
It's hard to say. Right now, there's a lot going on in the suborbital arena. There's an annual conference for the suborbital research, the Next Generation Suborbital Researchers Conference, and it's going to be the third year this February. And with that conference, it's bringing together scientists and these launch providers like Virgin Galactic, Mastin Space Systems, Sierra Nevada with their Dream Chaser, X-Core with Lynx. So all these vehicles and then linking them to the actual scientific community. And I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities for scientists, researchers, even graduate students, undergraduates to fly with their experiments in space. So think about how cool that would have been to be able to fly with their work on one of these flights and float free for 5 minutes and maybe pay attention to our experiment at the same time. So I think
good luck with that.
I think the first few flights are going to have to be, adjustment flights to make sure that you're ready to handle it before you actually go ahead and run your proper experiment. But I think the model is there that's one of the most likely ways that I might go to space or other people might go to space. Tomorrow, I actually plan to submit my astronaut application to NASA. So I'm hoping that that's, a potential way that I might go to space one day to be a part of that program. So I'm sure many people would love to be part of that program.
Yeah, I hope many people want to be part of that program. For several years, NASA was, some of the research wasn't going quite as well. There were problems with the shuttle program. And even now that we've retired the shuttle, there's this question of, what is happening with the astronauts program and, how do you get kids and a new generation of people to be excited about something that, doesn't even have its own way to get into space?
Yeah, it's, I think that's going to be the hardest part for the next five-ish years. It doesn't have that hey, let's go watch a shuttle launch down in Florida.
Yeah.
A connection that's really important. I've been able to go down to 4 or 5 shuttle launches all within the last couple of years, just because I was like, oh, I really need to see a launch. And then it became, oh, I really need to see another launch. And that becomes really important, is that it really does connect you to the program, and the excitement of being there is unbelievable. And they've been doing more and more of these tweet ups with NASA for the other launches with the Mars Science Lab. And it's the same kind of experience, but it's a lot different when there's a human riding on top of the rocket.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very different when you actually add people. Are there any of the private companies that are they launching anything, anything more this year with people?
I have no idea. I mean, I'd be a fortune teller. I'd probably be able to be a good gambler if I knew that. I know what I've heard in terms of what's expected for the year. I know that Virgin Galactic wants to start integrating their engine and doing incremental test flights where they'll burn the engine more and more the same way that Spaceship One did. And I'm not sure if I don't know. So we'd have to check this on with a official source, but at the end of the year would have been the first targeted suborbital flight. I know also that Dream Chaser had talked about doing a drop test with their vehicle. And so that's important because that tells them about the glide dynamics of how the vehicle comes back down. So that's with Dream Chaser for Sierra Nevada. So I think those two, we're going to see a lot. We're going to see a lot from X-Core as well. They've been testing their engine more and more. And that's going to be a different kind of experience than the other two, where you've got your pilot and your passenger and then a potential payload in the back. So it's just sort of a small, intimate experience. So all of these different experiences, you know, the ideal thing would be to be able to ride on each of these different rockets. You know, maybe I can do a little market comparison for them and tell them who's got the better ride. So, but I think that will happen. You'll have people who have the ability to go on all these different vehicles, and it's going to be pretty cool. I hope that we do have the options to have all these different experiences out there. And then more importantly, I hope the price drops like crazy, because being a postdoc, it's kind of like being a graduate student still. So it might be a while otherwise.
Yeah, there's a big difference between a postdoc salary and Richard Branson.
Yeah, just a little bit.
So. I think it's really, really exciting. I mean, the you know, even though maybe for the next 5 years, like you said, NASA is not going to be, is kind of going to be stalled in that arena. There's a lot of stuff going on, and it seems like a really exciting area to be a part of, that there, you know, are these different companies getting into it. The private arena is just growing. And there are a lot of companies that are growing around the area of going to space and space tourism. And so, you know, if you were to go back to being a fortune teller, how long do you think it's going to be before we really see like big growth in the space, like the public space economy?
Let's go 7 years. Why not? Just make something up.
Just make it up.
But I think it'll be somewhere between that transition of commercial vehicles being able to fly passengers like on Dragon for SpaceX. And it's going to take that much time just to get the kind of the baseline of flights going, where everything's safe and everything's going smoothly. And then it's going to take a few years to start getting the trust within that. And then we'll start seeing a lot of people fly. So 7 years, I think we're going to have a huge, huge boom. And it's going to be building up to that too. We're going to see Virgin Galactic's flights in the next few years, and with their paying passengers, but those are kind of the front end. They're kind of lead the charge for all of us. But I think let's go with 7 years.
Okay. I'm going to mark my calendar. We're going to check back in 7 years, 2019.
Yeah. That sounds like a good year. Why not?
Yeah. Why not? It sounds pretty good. For you personally, as we're moving forward in the in this space adventure, you know, what are you going to be doing next? You're working as a postdoc now. You're executive director with Yuri's Night. What are the big things on your calendar for the next year or so?
Well, I don't know, to be honest. I'm going to be busy with my work at MIT, working in the manned vehicle lab, doing some exciting stuff with spacesuits and IMUs. They're inertial measurement units. They're these little accelerometers the size of your watch that kind of like what you have in your iPhone, but it can tell you a whole bunch of stuff about the way you're moving and everything. So I'll be working on that through the summer. And Yuri's Night, I hope to be a part of that forever. Obviously, I'm not going to be executive director forever, but as long as they'll have me, I'll probably stick in there. So that's Yuri's Night's, like all the other executive members, it's all in our volunteer time. So we've got our global executive team that are working hard on our new website. They're working on our media in terms of getting the story out to people and help telling people what other people are up to. And our outreach team, who's going to be working on connecting everyone and really trying to get events in locations that we haven't had Yuri's Night events before. And then our operations team, who are kind of working behind the scenes to try to, you know, find sponsorships and develop partnerships. We have these memorandum of understandings with a bunch of our partners that we're excited to be involved with. So for me, I'll be involved with that, but, you know, we'll see what happens next. My NASA astronaut application goes into the interweb tomorrow, but that wouldn't be until next year anyway. And I'm busy applying for professorship positions and other commercial spaceflight opportunities, but kind of a free agent right now. So we'll see what happens.
Good luck with all of that. It seems very exciting. I'm excited for you. Everything you're doing is just very excited. So we are at the end of our hour, unfortunately. Aww. This has been a lot of fun. I'm just really excited about Yuri's Night this year. I know we're at the 51st, not the 50th, but the 51st anniversary of manned spaceflight only comes around once, just like the 50th. So it should be bigger and
very exciting.
Yeah, very exciting once again. So in April, Yuri's Night. I know that NASA near NASA Ames here near San Francisco does some neat stuff for Yuri's Night celebration. And anyone out there, go to yurisnight.net to see what's in your local area and see if you can get involved somehow. Or if you don't want to be involved, but you just want to attend and see what it's all about, you know, that's what you can do. Is there anything else that people should do, or is just go to the website, figure it out?
Go to the website. We're going to have our registration launching soon, but you can sign up there right now to get notified, be one of the first people notified about the full registration. But you can see a banner on our site says Make an Impact. That's our theme for the year. You click on that, fill out a web form, and we'll get your info and we'll get you set up. So you'll see a map on our site from last year with the 567 events on there, but there were over 600, including the International Space Station, which we didn't talk about, but that's okay. We'll save that for another show. Yeah. But we had the crew all wearing our Yuri's Night t-shirts. So there's photos of Ron Guerin and the crew. That was really cool, by the way. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Twitter, it's just Yuri's Night, all one word. And same with Facebook. You can find us there as well. And those are really good ways to be interactive with a global community and find out what we're doing next. And if you want to see what I'm up to, my Twitter name is Rye in Space, kind of like pigs in space. I'll update what I can when I can. And I usually have little Yuri's Night teasers there as well, saying kind of behind the scenes what the executive is working on. But for the most part, just kind of get out there, be passionate about what you're doing and have fun.
I second that comment. Be passionate about what you're doing and have fun. That's what I love to do. Thank you, Ryan, so much for joining me today on the Science Hour. This has been great. I've just really enjoyed talking with you. And like I said, good luck with everything. And I can't wait to celebrate Yuri's Night this year.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome. You are welcome. All right, everybody. That does it for another hour of Dr. Kiki Science Hour. And next week, I'll be back again. We're going to be talking about a new way of looking at multiple sclerosis. And so I hope you're interested. It's a very interesting idea. I'm excited. Until then, you can follow my sciencey pursuits all around the corners of the interwebs. If you go to Twitter, I'm Dr. Kiki. If you go to Facebook, I'm Dr. Kiki. Kiki Sanford on Google+. And you can always go to about.me/Dr. Kiki if you want to get links to all of the other things, just everything that I do. It's about.me/Dr. Kiki. And if you want to find past episodes of this program, you find, you know, 1 hour of science just isn't enough for your life, and you haven't listened to more episodes of this show, go on back in our library. twit.tv/Kiki is where you can find past episodes, and you can also subscribe to the show in audio or video format. I will see you next week. Thank you very much for tuning into my Science Hour. Remember that all I ask is this 1 hour a week, among maybe a couple of others. But, you know, this 1 hour a week. I do hope that it makes your world a whole lot more interesting. Now for your science meditation of the week. Somewhere in Eastern Europe, Russia, Asia, maybe. Anyway, they are... the species of crow, that bird was playing with some kind of a lid, using it as a snowboard. It tried one angle of the roof, worked really nicely, tried another, didn't work, went back to the original. And while this is a nice little story, it's just a little anecdote. You just see it happening, and, you know, scientists,